I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is poet Maider Vang, and her first book of poems, Afterland, has just been released. It is the winner of the Walt Whitman Award of the Academy of American Poets. It is an amazing book, and she's an amazing poet, so stick around, and we'll have a nice conversation with her. Maider Vang is the author of Afterland, which is the book we're going to talk about today, and it's just out from Grey Wolf Press. It received the Walt Whitman Award from the Academy of American Poets, and this is a great, big, huge award, and this book is amazing. Her poetry has appeared in Poetry, Virginia Quarterly Review, New Republic, and her essays have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle. She is a up-and-coming poetry star, and I'm very happy to have her on the show. Maider, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Afterland, winner of the Walt Whitman Award. My God, tell us about that moment when you found out that you won. What were you doing, and what was going on?
I get asked that question a lot, and my answer is always the same. I was really shocked, and when they had told me that I had won, I wanted them to double check, right? I wanted them to make sure they had the right person, but it was an incredible moment. I was stunned and excited and thrilled and all at the same time. It was incredible to know that out of these all the submissions, they had selected my work.
Yeah, that's quite an honor. It's quite a prestigious award. And I've been dipping into this book in the last couple of weeks. And my God, it's beautiful. It's painful. And it's certainly you're going to be among those American poetic voices that people are listening to. Does that feel like, wow, you know, people are going to listen to me? You know, how does that feel?
Well, you know, it's very humbling to know that the work is going to get out there. You know, I hope that people will read it and take something from it. But, you know, it's been a long way coming for among American writers and poets. So it's really exciting to see that this work is going to reach a larger audience.
Yeah, and it was chosen by Carolyn Forché. Of course, Master had been around for a long time and has also written about war. Do you have a relationship with her poetry?
Yeah, I first discovered her poetry as an undergraduate, and I actually wrote about it, too. I felt that connection because of her approach towards talking and writing about war. I was very compelled by it. And then to discover that she was the judge for this round of the Whitman Award, too, and to be selected by her, too, was a huge honor.
Yeah.
Unbelievably, yeah.
And that was just serendipity. I mean, it's not like she was your teacher or that she chose you because she knew you. She was just going on the poems themselves.
Yeah, it's exciting to think that she found something valuable and meaningful in the work, and she has a really heartwarming story of how she came across and selected the work. She mentioned that she was in France at the time and had brought multiple manuscripts with her to read and to assess, and when it came down to my manuscript and someone else's, she said what really moved her about my work was that something about it made her cry. And
wow.
that really sort of set it apart from all the other, you know, submissions. And her husband's like, well, you know, now you know who the winner is. And it was just incredible to think that my work had moved her in that way.
Oh, and, you know, I could picture her sitting outdoors in a cafe with the last two manuscripts and, you know, drinking one of those little tiny coffees and her just starting to cry. It's really a beautiful, beautiful image.
Yeah.
Have you been to Paris?
I have not yet, no.
You know, I wonder what you're going to think of it when you get there.
Yeah.
I want to ask you a little bit about the Hmong language. You don't use a lot of Hmong in this, but occasionally you do. And there's one word that really grabbed my attention, and it comes from the poem Light from a Burning Citadel. And the last two lines are in Hmong, and I don't want to read them because I'm sure I would mess it up, but that word, which is TXWM. How do you say that word?
The word that you're referring to in that poem is, so I'll read the whole sentence for you.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah, Beying Iti Yamong. So it's Ti, which just means, Iti means like eternally, forever. And the phrase translates to, we have always been Hmong. And in that poem, it's interesting that you point out that poem. I do a lot of code switching there and sort of integrating those refrains in Hmong to sort of contrast against what's happening in the English.
Yeah, and you've said something in the endnotes that really struck me. You said that word or there's a particular word, I forget the exact word, that means both father and fruit.
Right, yeah, there's another poem called Final Dispatch from Laos, where I use the word si, which in the Hmong language means father, but it also means fruit, too. Fruit as in, you know, anything you eat, bananas, apples, oranges. And so for me, I thought it was an interesting way to kind of examine that word within my own context, but within the context of the poem, because the father is sort of the root of that fruit and the giver of that fruit. And so the poem is exploring the loss of that root.
Yeah. And did you grow up speaking Hmong?
I did, yeah. Hmong was my first language.
Oh, mm-hmm. And are you still pretty fluent?
I do. I still speak Hmong. I read and write a little bit in Hmong as well, too, as you've noticed from the integration of some of the Hmong words. So, yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, it really strikes me about that dual meaning of a word being both father and fruit. It's something you could just really reflect on for a long time. And I'm thinking of any time we are interacting with two different languages and we realize something in one language and we try to, like, think of it in the other language, it really, you make some really interesting connections and you really begin to respect words in another level. Like, I'm thinking, like, in Spanish, for example, one of the biggest, you know, cultural jokes is that handcuffs and wife are the same word. You know, you have esposa and you have esposa. It means both handcuffs and it means wife. And of course, people have been making fun of that for years. But as I read more and more Spanish and speak more and more Spanish, I live in an incredibly bilingual community here on the border of U.S. and Mexico. I'm just fascinated by sometimes how words in one language mean multiple things that they don't mean in the other language, but then it causes me to think of the other language. I'm just wondering, how much of an advantage do you think there was growing up with two languages? Did it help you to see nuances in the English language that maybe a monolingual speaker may miss?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I was, you know, growing up, when you hear your native language and then you're also sort of immersed in learning English at the same time, you have access to these two different worlds, of two different bodies of vocabulary or two different sort of oceans of thought and language. And that's the advantage of a bilingual or trilingual speaker, is to be able to navigate and have access to both of these worlds. There's so many beautiful nuances, too, as you pointed out, in language, right? So there's a way in which you can lift out and create new meaning out of words that have those nuances and have those multiple meanings to them.
Yeah, I think that those who truly master their own language, and I don't think everybody does master their own language. I think people master their levels of communication quite effectively, but not everybody masters the language itself. But I think, you know, one of those things that leads us towards mastery is understanding the nuances of other language. I remember when I was a kid, we grew up, you know, in a bilingual house, although my parents insisted that we speak only English because Fresno at the time, I'm from Fresno as well, as you know, was incredibly racist. And so speaking Spanish was thought of as, you know, uneducated, which is kind of weird to think that two languages would make people feel that way. But I did grow up and I remember being at family reunions, family parties, Christmas, whatever, and falling asleep while the adults were talking Spanish, and how it just was so beautiful and so rhythmic and how it soothed me. And I'm wondering if also listening to other languages and understanding them, yet at the same time being immersed in one language, that there are perhaps these times when you hear the other language and you hear it as music first. And I'm wondering if that has any effect on our ability to hear the music and language in general.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm thinking about what you're saying about music. And for me, I love sort of paying attention to the sonics of a line in a poem, or the words and how, what the sound that they create when they come together. Mm. The Hmong language is a very tonal language. So, you know, when you have a slight variation in tone of a word, it changes the meaning, even though the word sounds the same. And so what that does for me as a poet and as a writer is I'm very attentive to the sound.
Oh,
and I value that, you know, the sound of a line, the sound of words, and sort of, you know, how, you know, for me, like I have this thing about monosyllabic words, words that, you know, are single syllable, and the way that they create this sort of dinging sound in some of the lines is something I really appreciate.
Wow, that's beautiful. I'm talking to Mai Dervang, poet. Her book is Afterland. It's a winner of the Walt Whitman Award. And that's really interesting that in certain tonal languages, like Hmong, I guess, that the tone you use or the way you say a word changes the meaning. That's kind of beautiful. It's even just thinking of it on a metaphorical level. And I guess, you know, in English, you don't have that, but you do have perhaps directed nuances and meaning by the way you say a certain word. But I could certainly understand. And it makes me think about some of your lines. Some of your lines are in this, well, they're all beautiful, but some of them just really captured me. Like, I'm going to read one. It's from a poem called Water Grave, which in itself is a beautiful title. But the line is, or the three lines really, the crowded dead turn into the earth's unfolded bedsheet. It's beautiful. The crowded dead turn into the earth's unfolded bedsheet. And when I read that, there's something complex going on within me because I want to read it and understand the sentido. I want to understand it, but yet at the same time, I don't care if I understand it because it just unrolls so beautifully. It's so, the sound of it is just, you know, I love the sound. And I'm wondering, when you're writing, do you allow sound to direct the meaning or to come first, and then, you know, the meaning has to be locked in there somewhere because it sounds so good?
Yeah, Yema, that's an interesting question, and thank you for the observation in that poem, Water Grave. You know, as a writer and a poet, it's hard to know what I privilege the most in terms of, you know, when it comes to kind of writing and crafting the poem. But sound is definitely up there. You know, for me, I kind of start with subject matter, and I think about, you know, what this poem is going to try to do and explore. And from there, the sounds just sort of come together. With the imagery, I think imagery is something that I've been told that I really sort of have been able to leverage and capitalize in a lot of these poems. But sound is definitely up there. I might sit and I might, you know, it takes me a while to find the perfect word, or not even the perfect word, but the word that I feel will resonate the most within that line. So yeah, sound is definitely a priority for me when I'm thinking about crafting these poems.
And you know what I truly believe? I think that language is so complex and the human brain is so amazing in terms of how we can give form to absolutely any phenomenon that surrounds us, whether it's seeing faces in the mountains or seeing animals in the clouds. We give meaning to the things that surround us. Our brains work in such an incredible way that I really believe that if we are presented with a beautiful sound, linguistically speaking, you know, a beautiful sentence or like the one I just read, that the brain will find meaning in it. And I think a lot of times that's really the key to understanding and appreciating poetry, that oftentimes the meaning is certainly clear, but then other times the poet, the language, the rhythm, the sound, and the reader, the brain that's processing it, they fit together very, very well. They have to.
Right, yeah. I think so. I think there's a way in which the brain is able to then eventually process what's happening in that poem and gather some kind of meaning from it, even if it's a lot of sounds, right, or a lot of images.
Right, which might be why a lot of undergraduates, and I don't mean that in a derogatory or snobby way. I hope I'm not sounding snobby. I was listening to one of the shows the other day, and I thought, man, you sound like a snob, Chuck Juan. But I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, those who are new to poetry are so frustrated with it, because they're trying to find a meaning that's separate from sound. And in order to experience it, you need to be able to submit to the sound and allow the meaning to, yeah, I guess, come later, or not come at all if it's necessary, but it's there.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I think with sound, you can discover where and how the poem might leap, right, you know, and where moments might go beyond what you would ever expect. That sometimes when you write a poem, you're like, I have no idea where this poem is going, or I don't even know what's happening in this poem, but something about it is working.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're talking about Afterland, a new book of poems by Mai Dervang. You know, you can just kind of swim in the language here. But one of the things that I really appreciate about poetry and introducing myself to new poems and new poets is I learn so many interesting words. And sometimes I wonder as I read a poem, you know, where did he or she come up with this word? And there's a word in one of your poems. It's fetlock. And I love the way that sounds, fetlock. I mean, it just really causes you to slow down. Fetlock. I had never heard of that word. Apparently, it's a particular part of the bone in a horse's leg. And I just couldn't help but wonder, my God, where did she find that word?
Yeah. You know, one of the things I was doing immensely when I was crafting a lot of these poems was I was sort of exposing myself to these new bodies of vocabulary. You know, the vocabulary of, you know, the natural sciences, the vocabulary of astronomy, mm-hmm. you know, and just really, you know, exploring what other words I could try. And fetlock was a word that really stuck out to me when I was learning about horses. I was, you know, researching, and I love the sound of that word because it does stop you. It almost sounds monosyllabic if you think fet and then lock, but then together they kind of have this beautiful compound sound of fetlock. And so, yeah, I love that moment. So that's why I had that word at the very end.
Yeah, I love that word now. And so I've even thought about writing a poem called Fetlock Clock, which is incredibly trite, but I'm a trite poet.
No, you should go for that. I'd love to read it.
And then the other word, I think I'm saying it right. It's gaur, gaur. And it means some sort of water buffalo or something.
Yeah. So the gaur is a water buffalo. And I was trying to think about ways in which to sort of, you know, only because when we think of buffalo, the water buffalo, we usually have the common reference of a water buffalo. But the gaurs were also very common in Laos. So that's why I went with the word gaur on that.
Wow. Yeah. But it's really a beautiful collection. And I'm going to ask you one more question about an aspect of this book. And then I want to talk a little bit about Fresno. And a little bit about you, but there's this one poem, and it's called Sojourn in the Snow. And it's a really interesting poem because it's about a speaker that has never experienced snow. And for the first time, this is how snow is introduced to them. And I think this is just really beautiful. A voice says, as they, I presume, they're holding out a handful of snow, they say, "It's like tiny diamonds that turn to water, taste like ice. Try it." It's really, really beautiful introduction to snow. Can you tell us a little bit about how this poem came about and how it really kind of speaks to the overall experience that this book seems to be about?
Yeah, that's interesting that you point out this poem, Sojourn with Snow. Yeah. So it is about sort of encountering snow for the very first time. When I was young, my sisters and I we'd never gone to the snow before, right? We'd never seen snow. We've only just watched it on TV. And one day, my uncle, who had been to the snow that day, he'd, you know, been up to the foothills where it had snow, and foothills in the Fresno County area, and he came home, and in the back of his pickup truck was just snow. So he had brought snow home for us. Uh-huh. And we were just thrilled. This was the first time that, you know, we refugee children, which is what kind of how I sort of referenced the poem, is that, you know, this is... You know, for refugee children, this is, we now believed that snow actually existed, you know, and that it's something that eventually goes away. And so that the poem is about that first encounter, that first experience with snow, and now believing that snow exists.
Yeah.
So, yeah, thank you for pointing out that poem.
And, you know, and it speaks so much of, at least partially, the experience that you write about. The Hmongs come from, as I understand it, and please correct me for my, you know, if I make an ignorant statement, but from Laos. And I don't suspect it snows much in Laos.
Yeah, definitely. It does not snow at all in Laos. You know, Laos being a tropical area, you know, it's very, you know, humid and rainy. So there's no encounter with this kind of element. And so when my parents were first resettled here in the United States, they were sent to St. Paul, Minnesota.
Oh, my God. Talk
and,
about
and
snow.
And there, right, they encountered snow. And for them, it was just the worst thing in the world, you know. And in this poem, I actually kind of referenced this, you know, the idea of hostile frost that gets settled to their skinny bodies because of that, you know, that snow. And so, yeah, it was definitely a climate change for them, an environmental change, and the change that comes with going to a new land as a refugee.
Right, right, yeah. And it reminds me of a friend of mine who grew up in the city, him and his little sister. They just grew up in L.A. all their lives in L.A., and then the first time they drove to El Paso with their parents on their way through Arizona, I don't know if you've ever driven through Arizona at night, but the stars are amazing. And his sister started crying. She just didn't know how to handle so many stars. That's something so new. And, you know, and what's interesting is there's so many narratives with stars and so many narratives with snow. And to suddenly be in a place with, you know, with snow where it's only been narrative, it really kind of just deepens on the experience, not only the immigrant experience, but just the experience of entering into a new world. And, you know, and it's a beautiful, beautiful poem, as is the entire book.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah.
I want to ask you a little bit about Fresno. And the only reason why is because I'm not only because I'm from Fresno, but we tend to have a lot of poets from Fresno on the show or that are somehow related to show. And it's not because, you know, I choose Fresno poets. It's because there's just so many incredible poets coming out of Fresno. I mean, of course, everybody immediately thinks of Philip Levine and Juan Felipe Herrera, but there's just so many other poets that have come out of there. Andres Montoya, Lee Herrick. I mean, you can just go on and on and on and on. And I'm wondering, what is it about Fresno, other than, you know, Philip Levine and the culture that he began to help create there, but what is it about Fresno itself that produces so many, disproportionately, I think, great poets?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm proud to be considered a Fresno poet and writer, and I'm proud to come from that tradition of writing. And, you know, I've thought about that question, like, what is it that's happening here in our valley? What does this place do to people to produce the writing and the poetry? And, you know, I feel like there's something about Fresno that allows us to experience life and the grit of life in a way that someone else in another part of the country doesn't, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there are certain things about Fresno that, you know, only Fresno people will ever really know and understand. You know, the summers, the poverty, the, you know, life in certain neighborhoods of Fresno, whether it's like Southeast or Central. You know, I was born and raised in Central Fresno area. So that part of me is very, I'm very tied and rooted to that area. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something about this space here where people kind of are just looking for a way to feel some kind of energy or something. And I can't quite pinpoint what it is, but there is, you know, a spirit about writing that has been generated, something in the ground, something, you know, some beauty that we're planting here that people are really feeding off of. And, you know, I'm proud to see that there are more and more writers coming out of here too. There's also the MFA program at Fresno State that's been also working with a lot of these writers as well. So, you know, it's a combination of so many things, I think. And there's also the diversity of communities that we're so proud to have here in the Valley.
Right. You know, I live in El Paso, Texas, and, you know, we're about 99.9999% Mexican. That's a slight exaggeration. We're actually maybe about 80% Mexican here, but it's an incredibly Mexican culture. And so when you eat, quote, ethnic food, and ethnic food here is just basically non-Mexican food, because Mexican food is not ethnic here. When you eat ethnic food, you're eating the Mexican version of it. Like sushi here has cheese in it, for example. But when you eat, for example, Indian food in Fresno, you are going to a strip mall or a neighborhood where there's a lot of Indians who live there and eat there and shop there. And it's just, it's a completely different experience it's a unique experience in terms of how diverse such a small city. It's about maybe 400,000. It's incredibly diverse, and it's got some weird energy and tension. And anyway, I'm probably going on too long about Fresno, but I love Fresno and I love the poets that come out of Fresno. And thank you for contributing not only to American poetry, but to poetry that has such an amazing tradition.
Yeah, I'm definitely proud to be part of that tradition and to help continue it as well for other writers who will carry the torch, you know, long after this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's happening. We're getting some great poets coming out of there. I had, you know, about a million other questions, but we're running out of time. So can we end with you reading a poem from Afterland?
Sure, yeah. I will do the poem on page 61. It's called When the Mountains Rose Beneath Us, We Became the Valley.
Oh, excellent.
When the mountains rose beneath us, we became the valley. I won't ask why the salva came to you, Father, or of the poacher who followed. But I ask of the country you lost, the one I never had, unlike the midwife who sketched birth maps on a girl's body and found a rainforest in her belly. I ask why a body is born to save money but can't pay to cross hell's ferry, or why snow tells us heaven is cold. A sunken missile maddens radiance as firework to the eyes of a tribesman witnessing for the first time. How did an ancient boy drown in a homeless river? I ask why the war-sick warrior who hunts with claws is hiding a poem. A piece of paper hides a garden. What harrowed you most arriving at the last minute to catch your brother's final breath on the hospital bed? Can a unicorn kindle the night, haloed by its flame, torches jutting from its head? Live on. Ask me how I've saved us. Ask me to build our temples so rooted, so stone, we won't ever die out.
That was Maidra Vang reading When the Mountains Rose Beneath Us, We Became the Valley, which is from her new book of poems, Afterland. Maidra, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to thank Maidra Vang for joining us. The name of the book is Afterland, and again, it is a Walt Whitman Award-winning book. I urge you to check this out. I'm Daniel Chacon. Thank you for joining me, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Words on a Wire.